Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Compliance Guy podcast. As always, let me begin by saying thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and just hanging out with us for a little while. I'm so excited because it has only taken 25 days in the month of January to be able to get our first legal with Lyles and Parker back onto the air. But I'm really excited because, you know, they say sometimes you have to wait for great things to come to you. And Ashley finally came to me with a great topic. So we'll pick right up where we left off with the abuse from my very, very close and dear friend who I love very much, Robert Lyles. So I'm really excited to have Ashley and Robert back onto the program. I know so many of you have been asking me, you know, when's the next episode of the Legal with Lyles Parker, because they're always so in depth, so informative, such great content. And, you know, we're here and we're rolling. So our topic of discussion today is focusing on the 2024 healthcare fraud risk areas. And I think one of the biggest things that jumps out to me is something that that Robert and Ashley put together for our talking points today, but something that I've been talking about since 2023. And that's, we have entered into a new era in our industry of over-aggressive audits and overzealous prosecutions. The audits that we are seeing at the state level, at the commercial payer level, at the federal level, are mind-boggling to me with some of the horse crap that these auditors are throwing out as rationales for why they have a right to deny a service or why they're doing a clawback on something. And the administrative process, I think, once again, is getting bogged down. I think the judges are going to start to get frustrated as these cases of medical necessity that are being determined by non-clinical individuals at the payers continue to rise. And defense attorneys like Robert and Ashley and other members of their incredible team continue to bring clinical experts in to these administrative proceedings to testify to the medical appropriateness necessary or necessity and reasonableness of the services, talking about generally accepted standards of medical practice, and judges having to look at, you know, solid testimony from clinical individuals versus those who are simply following a sub-regulatory guidance document that doesn't have the effect of law. So I know I've given you a mouthful, but I want to go ahead and start with the very first of the risk issues, and it has to do with administrative risks. So, Robert or Ashley, who wants to take the first one?
I can cover it. On the administrative side, we've really seen a huge uptick already this year. It started out really last fall, but it's picked up already this year from the UPICs. And one area of the UPICs that has picked up more than the other is their audits of Medicaid providers. You know, for a while there, after they took over, you know, at one point we had MICs, Medicaid Integrity Contractors. They took over for the MICs. There was at least a year period where they were just missing. They were not doing much of anything with Medicaid. Those days are over, okay? And it's very important that you understand that just because you've got a UPIC that is conducting the audit, don't think that you've got the regular appeal rights that you have under Medicare if it's a Medicaid case, okay?
That's right.
So you got 50 different sets of appeal rights once that UPIC is done. Also, the other thing that I think is worth pointing out is that in the early days, and Sean, you and I have been doing this a long time, all they really did in those days, once in a blue moon, you get an ADR. But for the most part, it was always post-payment audits.
That's right.
Those days are behind us as well. We still get some post-payment audits, but frankly, you know, CMS's statement that we're going to deal with Pay and Chase, they're doing their best to actually deal with it. So we're seeing a lot more TPE audits, ADRs, prepayment review audits. They're different programs, different procedures, but it's all the same thing, really. You know, they want to see the medical documentation before they're going to pay the claim, right? The other thing that we're seeing, of course, on the UPIC side is they're becoming very aggressive when it comes to, if they find a problem, they're not just stopping at denying the claim. Ashley really can tell you more, but we're seeing a lot more revocations and suspension actions.
That's right. I mean, I have multiple cases now that have started out as, you know, a smaller probe audit. And then, you know, instead of just issuing the decision on the probe audit, we're getting either a subsequent records request for a larger sample or, you know, a trifecta. The small audit, you get a bigger audit request and you get a suspension notice. And then you're not getting paid. You're trying to figure out how you're going to continue to offer services while you're, you know, not getting paid, but Medicare, it's a mess for providers. And some providers also get placed on prepay during that period as well for the suspension period.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that jumps out to me, and, you know, I always try to keep politics out of things, but it's really hard when our industry is controlled by the government, right? Yes, we have private health insurance, but the government still meddles in that as well. And I don't think anyone can disagree that under this current administration, things have gone from bad to way worse than what they've ever been. I think the Justice Department has completely taken this thing on Mr. Toad's wild ride. The cases that I've been a part of, you know, last year, I testified in 10 federal, civil, and or criminal cases, and I consulted on more than 50 federal, criminal, and civil cases last year. By far the biggest year I've ever had. It is just the last week of January, basically, that we're into now. I told my partners this year, 10 cases was way too much for me last year. And I don't have to tell you guys as litigators, and Robert as a former prosecutor, how much work goes into preparation for these kind of cases. I said that I was only going to take 5 or 6 cases this year. I have just signed my 4th case already, and they keep coming in. So, that puts me into a hard situation because, you know, I want every provider to have the best possible defense that's available to them. And I sometimes feel like if I walk away from a case and then I read about it 6 months later and the doctor was convicted, I'm like, oh man, what could I have done differently? And then, you know, one of the attorneys from your law firm has reached out to me today, Lester, who I absolutely love. And we were both working on a similar case and we both had to leave that case, and it did not turn out well for that physician. But now, reading the government's opposition for a new trial, you know, you start reading about how this doctor wasn't afforded due process. He didn't get to have a coder testify on his behalf at the trial. The government's expert basically knew that, and in my opinion, I think blatantly lied because there was nobody to call them out on it. So, you know, providers need to wake up and, you know, they need to realize that this isn't fun and games. This isn't you just getting to practice medicine. This is a business where if you make a mistake, it has serious consequences that are life altering, not only for you, but for your entire family, for your staff, for your partners, and for your community at large.
That's right. That's right, Sean. I just talked to somebody yesterday who was calling me that had, you know, like $800,000 overpayment and trying to figure out, you know, how they're going to pay that, how they're going to continue to practice. Can I shut this down? Is overpayment going to follow me? And I mean, there's serious repercussions when you get into, you know, big overpayments and referrals to law enforcement. It can be very scary.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not even the financial damages that are the problem these days. It's the revocations. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the fact that you've gone to school for 12, 14, 18 years, depending on your specialty or subspecialization and your residency and internship. And now all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of dollars that you've spent going to school that you're still paying off. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And don't forget now, they've expanded the revocation reasons that they can go after you. And they've extended the period from 3 years to 10 years.
And
that's right.
It's unbelievable. So, all right. So our first risk area and just to, you know, put it into summation, you know, is that the administrative risks have undoubtedly increased. They've shifted more from the post-payment audits to these really extreme adverse actions.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Any last takeaways on that?
Well, on the administrative side, I do think it's worth pointing out that there's a lot of bad information out there. We were Ashley and I just spoke at a conference, and I was talking about the fact that you cannot wait to really put both oars in the water if you're going to appeal these denials. You can't wait till the ALJ. You've got to really go into it 110% at redetermination. And someone raised their hand and they said, that's not what we've been told. Our advisor told us that, you know, let's just not spend a lot of money. Let's wait till ALJ. The statistics are out there and they're not good. You know, only 10% of the claims these days are favorable, and, you know, only about 29% of the cases. And, you know, Sean, you and I have done this a long time. And in the very beginning, of course, we had, well, in the old days, the judges that handled ALJs were Social Security judges.
That's right. Very compassionate.
Very compassionate. Yeah. And a good example, of course, is the treating physician rule. You know, they're used to, in those days, they could actually consider the fact of the treating physician, what the treating physician thought, and give it predominant weight.
That's right.
In Medicare appeals, they weren't supposed to, but the fact is they were such nice guys that in the back of their head, it was always there.
Right. You know, there was a fantastic case, Holland v. Sullivan, that the judge in that case said, you know, you have to give deference to the treating physician rule, because who better to know how to care for the patient than the person who's taking care of that patient? And even in the face of published guidance from the medical community, if a provider believes that there has been advancements or there's a better way, that it is binding on the secretary to give deference to that treating physician. And when they did away with the treating physician rule under the Social Security Administration, It was a huge injustice to providers, but we still make the arguments in Medicare cases,
and they still
accept. So let me ask you this question. So what happens if we have a non-UPIC, right? A non-UPIC CMS contractor who identifies the evidence of fraud, right? Mm-hmm. What guidance is there that providers can understand why they are being referred to a fraud investigative entity like a UPIC?
That's in the program integrity manual. There's a provision there in chapter 1, section 1.3.6 that says contractors shall analyze provider compliance with Medicare coverage and coding rules and take appropriate corrective action when providers are found to be noncompliant. For repeated infractions or infractions showing potential fraud or abuse, potential fraud or patterns of abuse, more severe administrative action shall be initiated. At any time, evidence of fraud shall result in referral to UPICs for development.
So, I mean, it's clear, right? It's clear that there are repercussions. There are steps that the contractors can take to, if they believe They don't have to have proof. They just have to have a hunch, a concern.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all coming from where? Data mining.
Mm-hmm.
It's all data mining. So let me ask you this question, Robert. You know, why does it even matter? I mean, you know, the fact is providers who are appealing their claims, you know, those denials, they're always going to prevail at the ALJ, aren't they?
No, that's the whole point. These days, they're not. The guys that you and I used to deal with before the Medicare Modernization Act, they were the Social Security judges, of course. Those guys that switched over, that migrated over from the Social Security Administration when they had to switch, most of those guys, frankly, are retired now and gone. And it's a whole new class of ALJs. And these ALJs have been trained, to really take a hard line position. And the statistics show that providers are not winning a majority of the cases at ALJ. And that's why you have to put both feet in the water early at redetermination and reconsideration.
So I'm looking at some numbers that you all provided. And just to give you an idea, okay, let's look at a 10-year historical trend. In 2014, 37% of the cases that went to an administrative law judge were adjudicated on behalf of the appellant, meaning they got a favorable finding.
Correct. Fully favorable.
Yeah. Fully favorable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fully favorable. That means they won every claim.
That's right. Fully favorable. In 4 short years, that number was cut in more than half, down to 17% for fully favorables. Now, the numbers have been steadily climbing back up, and at the end of 2023, they were at 29%. So we are starting to see a shift back towards more fully favorable findings, but we're only 30%. We're still looking at partial favorables of only 2.6% and 50% being unfavorable.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I think that the numbers in 2023, even these judges, I believe, are sympathetic to the fact that in 2020, in 2021, we had COVID. And they're giving folks the benefit of the doubt a lot of times in terms of documentation. You know, so that's why I believe it takes a couple, even with the backlog knocked out for the most part, we can tell you from the cases that we handle, if we have a case that was already 5 years old, it still hadn't been scheduled. But if we have a case that comes in tomorrow, you know, they put that on the calendar very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the 2023 decisions, I believe, are looking at 2020 and 2021 cases.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, another attorney that I do a lot of administrative law judge work with, Amanda Wesch,
mm-hmm.
They are all from the COVID time period right now, all of these claims that we're looking at. All right. So let's jump to risk issue number 2. This one's really kind of, again, you know, falling in line to what we were talking about just a moment ago with respect to Medicare revocation actions and the expansion of those actions. Ashley, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. So CMS has, since 2019, they've significantly expanded their revocation authority, but most recently, with the federal rule that was published in November of 2023, they had some additional proposed additions and updates to their already broad, you know, like 22 different reasons they can revoke you. We've, you know, made some more additions. The ones that I think are the most important is that for a revocation for non-compliance, that has been changed to include, you know, you have to be in compliance with all enrollment requirements, regardless of where those enrollment requirements are identified within Title 42. So it's not just a specific number of enrollment requirements, it's every single enrollment requirement. So everything that you're putting on your 855, that needs to be correct. You need to make sure you're in compliance. You need to make sure you maintain compliance. If there's a change in any of those pieces of information, that needs to be updated within the timeliness requirements, whether that's 30 days or 90 days, depending on what it is. So you need to make sure that you are in compliance with that. Another big one that I think is really interesting is the revocation reason related to False Claims Act civil judgments. So this one, says that CMS is going to modify its revocation authority to allow CMS to revoke the enrollment of a provider or supplier or any owner, managing employee, or organization, officer, or director that has a civil judgment under the False Claims Act imposed against them within the previous 10 years. However, it says that the term civil judgment would not include a False Claims Act settlement. So they're pushing providers to settle to avoid repercussions from CMS.
It's the carrot and the stick.
Mm-hmm. And mostly stick.
Well, yeah. Well, you beat me to the punch. You know, the carrot is, hey, we won't revoke you if you settle, but you're going to pay the price in that settlement. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, the deck, and I hate to say this, but it's the truth. The deck is stacked against providers.
Yeah.
Well, it's really tough. And we haven't even seen the full impact yet of all the changes that they've made with regard to enrollment. Enrollment is not one of the risk areas that we put down there, but it's going to be one that we've got to talk about pretty soon, because they have expanded it to where if you have an owner or a manager who has worked at an organization that had an overpayment, maybe it shut down, maybe it went bankrupt, whatever, you know, those folks are going to be paying the price for even being affiliated with that company that left owing money.
Well, it's guilt by association.
Yeah. That's right. That's
absolutely. Absolutely. It's mm-hmm. just absolutely mind-boggling to me. And, you know, one of the things that really scares me is knowing that the Department of Treasury gets involved in this stuff, mm-hmm. because DOT, and I'm not talking about the Department of Transportation, talking about the Department of Treasury, they don't care. They are going to suspend your accounts. They're going to go after your personal accounts. They're going to go after everything they can to be made whole and, you know, yeah. sort it all out in the end. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm so glad that I decided to do the kind of work that I'm doing as opposed to sticking on the clinical side, because I probably would have been one of those on the front page of the USA Today in handcuffs being escorted out of it. I'm just kidding. Well, who knows? All right.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, though, because the whole debt issue is one that now they can use as a basis to revoke you.
Absolutely.
It is. That's what I was just talking, like I said earlier, I was just talking to an individual about that yesterday and about how if you own multiple companies, those can all be impacted and revoked, or when you have to, you know, recertify your enrollment, you're going to have to report that you were a managing employee or an owner of another company that had an overpayment. And that's going to, that subsequently is going to get you revoked. And you know, the individual asked me, well, can I negotiate the debt with CMS? And, you know, I have tried to negotiate debts with CMS, and the general stance that I get back from CMS is that we want everything.
Oh, absolutely.
Everything back. We either have everything or nothing. I've actually gotten a settlement approved by Treasury that CMS has subsequently rejected. You know.
So funny that you bring that up, because I actually have a case, and Robert, you actually know the one that I'm talking about out of Texas, where the DOJ actually agreed to the settlement and CMS came back and said, absolutely not. And after we made a proffer last week, and it was really fascinating for me to get to present to the DOJ and to CMS, and for them to hear me as a subject matter expert, non-attorney, explaining to CMS using all of their own coverage guidance why they were wrong. And now CMS is actually coming back to the table and saying, okay, let's actually talk about how much we really owe. It's unbelievable. But yet they bankrupted this organization mm-hmm. in the process. Mm-hmm. All right. Another area that I think is so smart for you guys to really talk about is the third of the risk issues, which is private payer audits and the frequency to which we're seeing them and how complex they have become.
We are seeing tons of private payer audits on a wide spectrum of providers all of the private payers, commercial pay, advantage plans, all they are out there. They are looking at providers. They are just as aggressive as CMS is. They will extrapolate. Whether or not they have the authority to extrapolate, they will extrapolate. And then they'll say, oh, well, we might not have the authority, but do you want us to look at all of your claims?
Well, listen, let me tell you, the first thing that I do, and I've said this to Robert 100 times, because every time I've done it, I was right. I call BS on their statistical analysis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They don't have the competency.
No.
They don't have the people to do an SVRS.
Mm-hmm.
They don't test the sample frames. They don't get the point estimates. They don't give you the precision ratings. When they don't test for repeatability, you have a fatally flawed sample.
Right.
And as a fatally flawed sample, you can't extrapolate it, because your extrapolation becomes fatally flawed. You know how many times we pushed back and we said, give us all of your sample frames, give us everything. You claimed you use RATstats. RATstats gives us everything for the steps that you actually went, and they never produce it. So they say, well, you know, we call it a statistically valid random sample, but that's our own interpretation of it. And, you know, no, it doesn't work that way. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I tell them is, you got two choices. You could either back off and let's go ahead and do 100%, which they're never going to do. Or we come to the table and we tell them, we did our own internal audit using an independent, objective third party that actually used a computational statistician, did it correctly, not only using RATstats, but used SAS or Medisoft or Meditab. We got it all, and we determined that it was a 13% error rate, and we determined that the actual overpayment was X. And they wind up saying, fine, just send us the money. I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying it, but really, in the last several months, that's really what we've dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do find, I mean, the problem with the commercial payers is that especially for a provider, is that their appeals process can be very unclear. And the providers get upset because they're like, what's their authority to audit me?
I don't know. Unclear. They don't even have an audit process.
That's right.
They make it up as they go.
That's true. That's very true. Or they say, oh, well, you know, you don't get an appeal at all. It's like, excuse me. That's right. Yes. No.
We are judge, jury, and executioner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I will say they will horse trade. That is something that I do see with the commercial payers. They will enter into settlement discussions.
They will.
And they will settle for you know, reasonable amounts, but they can be very aggressive. I mean, we've seen them ask for audit trails because they, you know, if they think a provider is, you know, committing fraud or, you know, up to bad practices or doing something inappropriate, they are taking a hard look at that as well. And they can make referrals.
So talk about, and they can, that's a great point. And I want to come back to that in a moment, but quickly, can you talk about what constitutes an audit trail?
Yes, sure. So an audit trail, you know, most providers now are using EMRs, electronic medical records. And within that electronic medical record, there is something called an audit trail. And that audit trail basically is a history of every single change that has been made in that EMR system. So even if you go in and it doesn't look like you've changed anything, there is a separate trail log in the EMR that will say this user did this at this time, made this specific change. So even if it looks like you've never changed a note and it was signed, you know, the day you did it, they can look, you know, there's a way to figure out if you changed it and modified it to make it look like it was correct on the day you entered the note, but then you actually changed it, you know, 2 years later, which
would we call it a keystroke entry log. So same thing, audit trail. You know, when was the patient record accessed? Who accessed it? What additional information was added? The information that was changed or deleted, and why the information was important from an enforcement standpoint. So I'm with you. Robert, I don't think a lot of folks understand the ability that a commercial payer has to make a referral to an entity like the Office of Inspector General or the Department of Justice.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, you know, every one of these private payers has what's known as an SIU,
That's
Special Investigations Unit. And a lot of those guys, frankly, are retired FBI or postal inspectors. By the way, in my opinion, the very best investigators are from the Postal Service.
I agree.
Outstanding. You know, they really get in the weeds. Anyway, so these are folks that already have contacts with law enforcement. And in fact, in most judicial districts, like one time I spoke for at one of their quarterly meetings at the U.S. Attorney's Office. This is when I was in private practice, but all the SIUs would send their folks in, and they have quarterly meetings with DOJ. And if they've got evidence of a falsification of a medical record or healthcare fraud, you know, the easiest thing for them to do, they could, of course, terminate you, which is like the kiss of death these days, because then all the other insurance companies are going to do the same thing, or at least they're going to try to. But they may not even want to do that. They may just want to say, you know what, we think this is a bad guy. We have evidence here that they have defrauded our insurance plan. Let's make a referral. Well, the only way that DOJ can proceed in that type of a case is criminally.
That's okay. Right.
They can't go after you under the False Claims Act. It's not federal monies.
That's right.
So, you got a problem. Healthcare fraud is 1349. And you know, that's what they will do. And that's why we're seeing more and more of these cases brought for fraud against these private plans, because the government will take them. The SIUs will bring it in just with a bow on it and say, here's the evidence.
Yep. And you're talking about 18 USC. I think it's 1347, yes. Which
1347 is 1347.
Conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud. I think it's 1347.
1349 I thought is what it was. Well, anyway, the point though is,
doesn't matter.
Yeah. The point though is you have to be very careful.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. You know, listen, you know this. I'm actually an investigator and an auditor for a composite medical state board here on the East Coast. And the number of SIU packets that I have received is unbelievable, because they've already made referrals to OIG, to DOJ, but now it's coming to the composite medical board for further disciplinary action against their license, mm-hmm. whether suspension, fine, termination, mm-hmm. whatever it may be. And, you know, I will tell you, as somebody who has always been a physician advocate, I am very slow to escalate things up to the medical board, even though there may have been an adverse action or a settlement by a provider with OIG or DOJ. I look at the entire context of the case, because I look for fatal flaws, or I look for things that were overlooked as part of the case, where maybe the provider didn't have proper representation, you know, from a coding expert or an auditing expert or a compliance expert. And, you know, it's up to me as an independent objective reviewer to say, I got a problem with this, and here's the reason why I have a problem with this. I get that they pled guilty or they settled or whatever, but I think had they known these facts, things may have turned out a little bit differently. And I think people, especially attorneys who are not healthcare attorneys with the range of experience and tenure of a Robert Lyles or an Ashley Morgan or some of the other brilliant minds that I get the privilege of working with every day, they hire attorneys who are white collar criminal attorneys, but they do all kinds of stuff. And healthcare just happens to be something they dabble in. You can't dabble in healthcare.
That's right.
And I think there's a grave injustice, and if I dare to say it, sometimes malpractice on the part of individuals who are taking on healthcare cases that have no right taking on a healthcare case from a legal representation standpoint. I think that's just in bad form.
Yeah. I mean, healthcare is its own animal.
It is. You know, I talk about this all the time. We have more rules, regulations, laws, statutes, and acts in healthcare than any other industry, with the exception of nuclear. Mm-hmm. That is the only industry that parallels to what we have. It's mind boggling. Mm-hmm. All right. So The Rise of the Smirk. This one I love because I don't think people actually understand what a supplemental medical review contractor actually does and just how powerful they're actually becoming. So,
yeah, we have seen so many smirk audits. And what's interesting is that, you know, historically, I see, you know, the normal smirk audits that Noridian lists on their web. So Noridian acts as a smirk. Noridian is a Medicare administrative contractor, and then they also act as the smirk, which is a supplemental medical review contractor, which is a special contractor that is tasked to look at specific risk areas that typically CMS has identified. And typically, CMS will say these are the claims that you need to audit for the specific time period. Look at these specific jurisdictions. And then there is a specific process that those providers get to go through. Typically, they will send in the medical record documentation. They get a response back. You get an opportunity for education. You get an opportunity for re-review. And then they issue another decision. And then you can take that through the administrative appeals process. But what I've seen within the past year, at least, is that in addition to the regular projects that Noridian lists on their website, they are also receiving specific reviews from the Office of Program Integrity at CMS to do additional reviews that are not listed as special projects on their website. I've seen this specifically targeted at hospice companies. A lot of times hospice companies that have a high volume of patients who have Alzheimer's diagnoses, but those are not listed on their website. They're a different project ID than the projects that are listed on the website. And those don't follow the standard SMRC review process. You don't get the opportunity for re-review. You don't get the opportunity for education. They just, you know, if they don't make a referral, they're issuing an overpayment, and then you're losing out on an opportunity for a re-review, and you just have to fight it through the system. And the providers don't understand that. So they're not responding aggressively when they sent those records in the first time.
Yeah, the smirks are going to play a significant role in 2024. I agree with you 100%. All right. So one of my favorite part is, you know, for us, there's always a lightning round. So, Robert, I want to start with you because these are some of my favorite additional risk areas. I talked about these in an article that I wrote in Q4 of 2023, Things to Be Aware of. We've had conversations throughout 2023, the three of us, about some of these topics. So private equity firm acquisitions in the healthcare space, good, bad, or ugly?
I think it can be ugly, especially when you combine that with the new or the updated, I guess, DOJ policy for mergers and acquisitions. And the reason is because this. Historically, private equity companies, when they come in and they find a target, they're looking at the numbers. That's what they're looking at. And that's all they really care about. Versus if you have a provider-to-provider purchase, yeah, they're going to look at the numbers, of course, but they're going to do some real due diligence into the work that's been provided, you know, the medical necessity of that work. Was it coded right? Was it billed right? Hopefully, it's going to be done, you know, thoroughly. And all of this really matters because under the new DOJ merger rules, you know, if they buy a company, they've only got a very discrete period of time to do a voluntary disclosure. And, you know, otherwise they will essentially assume that risk and they'll be responsible.
And they don't understand that these, you know, that's the dangerous thing about these portfolio companies that are trying to get into the healthcare space, especially with our next topic that we're going to talk about. They're not realizing that when you perform due diligence, it's not standard due diligence like you're buying another type of company. When you buy a healthcare company, you've got to look at the potential liabilities. Not just those that are known, but the potential. And that's why these PE groups that are buying these physician groups and these laboratories and these diagnostic imaging centers and dental groups, if you're not doing a due diligence audit that includes the review of medical documentation, the coding, the billing, the charges, the payments, and the adjustments, mm-hmm. a full revenue cycle analysis, you're missing the boat. Right. And to Robert's point, you have a finite period of time to be able to disclose overpayments to the government under Section 6402B of the Social Security, of the Affordable Care Act, which is also known as the 60-day rule. All right.
Yeah. Now, one thing though, I mean, you got to keep in mind with these private equity purchases, I haven't seen one where it was just an asset purchase. It's always a stock purchase because when they buy these companies, they don't want to have to go to all the trouble to re-sign up and get re-credentialed with all the plans. Essentially take those numbers when they buy these companies. And when they do that, they're buying the liability too.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's right. It's insane. It's insane. All right. One of my favorite topics that I think will be at the top of my hit list for 2024 is AI. You can't open a magazine. You can't open a social media, platform. You can't even go on to LinkedIn without LinkedIn giving you a little button that says rewrite with AI now. Mm-hmm. And I have tried it and I am not a huge fan. I prefer my misspelling to what they actually give me for jumbled words. So Ashley, let's talk about artificial intelligence and why it's so critical.
It is. I mean, we're seeing it. It's everywhere, right? It's everywhere. The payers are going to be using it. CMS is, we've seen that some UPICs have capabilities to use it, and providers are going to be using it. And it's very scary because we've already seen some cases where providers are facing consequences for improperly using AI to, for example, create x-rays and change x-rays for their patients to show that there was a change and to justify the services that were provided. Providers are going to be utilizing AI to draft treatment notes. And we already have a problem with cloning.
That's right. And, ChatGPT.
Yeah. And so providers that are using these artificial intelligence tools need to make sure they're doing it in a way that it's proper, that it's not guiding their medical decision-making, that their notes are still unique to the patient. And it's just a very sticky issue, especially because the payers are going to be using it as well to do their reviews. And so it's going to be able to pick up on the fact that all of these things look similar or, it's just, and they can analyze, your x-rays to see if there, if there's actually been a change. It's just, it's a very, very serious situation and people need to not just run haphazardly into utilizing it.
Well, Terry Fletcher and I, the other day on our hashtag Terry Tuesday, actually did an episode on cloning, cut and paste and clinical plagiarism. And Medicare has taken the position that it doesn't even have to be identical. If the language is similar, it could negatively impact whether or not the service was medically necessary and whether or not it justifies remuneration. So AI, while people are clamoring to it, while people are excited about it, I am one of those who says, go cautiously. I showed one of my providers the other day, as actually last week, an orthopedist who had said to me, I want to take a look at this ChatGPT platform for physicians because, I have buddies of mine who are telling me, what used to take them 2.5-3 hours to get through all their patient notes is taking them like 10 minutes. And he's like, so we went in and literally I said, well, give me a typical patient that you're seeing. And he gave me one for, knee, osteoarthritis and, he's going to do injections and, weight bearing and PT and this and that. So we put in all the parameters and it spit out within 30 seconds at most, this note that had all of these citations and all of these clinical trials and studies and this. So we went and we actually dissected it and it took us about 20 minutes to do it. And we dissected it. Do you know that more than 50% of the citations that were in there were incorrect? Wow. They didn't even make sense. And the doctor looked at it and he goes, well, I know what your answer is going to be. And I said, you're darn right. As long as you're my client, yeah, I will not sign off on you doing anything through AI from a progress note standpoint. Okay. Robert. This has been one that's really interesting because this ties back into the COVID-19. the multiplex PCR laboratory testing in outpatient practices. Mm-hmm. What is so risky about that?
Well, the problem is, I mean, every case is different. You have to look at the different machines, but there are a number of machines out there that have gotten to where they're within the budget of a practice. And the practice says, why don't we go on and purchase this for the practice? We can get the results faster for our patients. We don't have to send this out. And, you know, according to these folks, it's a lot more accurate if we do it locally. So, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, the global billing and the whole nine yards if they can do it in-house. The problem is we've had a couple of cases where they bought machines that if someone comes in, for instance, for gastro, you know, and they need to check for certain organisms. You can't just check for one or two organisms. It tests them all mm-hmm. at the same time. And the docs then, and I'm sure it's because they probably heard this from a salesperson, don't know, but, you know, probably, they say, well, you tested for all of them, so you need to bill for the full panel. And while understanding, of course, that the machine only does the full panel, mm-hmm. period.
That's right.
So it's real hard to explain to the doc that even though you are testing for the full panel, you have to justify why you're not only billing for 1 to 6 organisms or 7 to 15 or whatever it's going to be, you know, because the others weren't really medically necessary. Mm-hmm. And you're going to pop up on a data mining run, you know, with a big red light because you're only billing at the mm-hmm. highest code.
That's right. That's right. Like I said, the number of laboratory cases that are coming across my desk since last year is outpacing just about every other specialty. It's unbelievable.
Well, Sean, this really relates back to issues that you and I have talked about, whether it's PSTEM or whatever it is. These salespeople, I'm not saying they're lying. They don't know better, but they will come in and they will sell you, you know, some piece of equipment with a guarantee, they'll say, that Medicare will cover it.
Listen, I can't make this up. I have one of my specialty practices, an orthopedic group, who just reached out and said, I already know what you're going to say, but I just want to hear you say it. They got an email from a sales team on incorporating behavioral health services and screening questionnaires as a separate tool and billing that with a CPT code to the insurance companies for remuneration as an orthopedic group. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding? First off, look at how protected behavioral health and addiction medicine records are under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Number two, what competencies does an orthopedic surgeon have that they can demonstrate that they have the right to put patients onto behavioral health drugs?
And what kind of diagnosis is going to be on there that's even going to be an automatic edit?
Yeah, I said to him, I appreciate you always reaching out to me, but there are certain things that you should just know. Don't reach out to me for. You know my answer. All right. Hospice services, true or false, Ashley, they are going to continue from 2023 all the way through 2024 and beyond as a huge target.
True. We have seen so many hospice cases and that is not slowing down anytime soon.
All right. And the last one, before I opine on this one, I want to see, Robert, the direction you're going to go. GLP-1 and type 2 diabetes drugs. Give me your take on this and let me see where you fall on this spectrum.
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's a wonderful development for people that need to lose weight. The problem, though, is if you're talking about billing it to an insurance company, there are only very limited situations where Medicare is going to cover it. And what you don't want as a doc is, you know, if someone is just big, unless they've got type 2 diabetes and they qualify under the coverage rules for you to prescribe this, don't be putting down that they've got some diagnosis that they don't have just so you'll get it covered. You know, I mean, this is something that that's a real problem. The other problem that we've got out there is all the off-labeling and all the compounding that's going on, because these drugs are very, very expensive. And there are a number of compounding pharmacies who will say, well, you know, for this particular one, we can come up with the same thing. It's the generic version. It's half as cheap. You know, that's fine, as long as you feel comfortable with that and the patient feels comfortable with that, and you're not billing insurance as if it is the name brand drug. But be careful, because if you're bringing things in from overseas off label, you can have all kinds of labeling problems and all kinds of issues. This is going to be a much bigger deal this time next year, because that's when all the insurance companies are going to get around to conducting audits of these claims.
Yeah. I agree 100% with everything you said. I have an issue with it from the standpoint that, listen, I understand people get to a point where they become desperate. They've tried every diet fad. They've tried exercise. They've tried different things. And now there are these commercials that have been put out there, these articles that have been put out there by these wellness centers, by these different groups, without, in my opinion, enough clinical evidence to show the long-term effects, mm-hmm. both positive and mm-hmm. negative, for the use of these biologics.
But one of the big problems, of course, is a lot of the weight you're losing is not fat, it's muscle.
That's a big problem. But what potential does a person have to become immune to treatment should they develop diabetes? You know, there's questions that have to be answered. The other thing that scares me is how quickly people are being shuffled from this drug, from Ozempic to Waduvia to Januvia to this one to that one. And, you know, people are self-dosing themselves. I have somebody who told me they started with two. It did nothing to curb their cravings. It did nothing to curb their appetite. They increased on their pen themselves and their dosing to a 5 without even consulting with a physician.
Yep.
And now they're self-medicating themselves. This is so dangerous. Listen,
I mean, that sounds like what happened with Botox. You know,
there you go.
People would have Botox parties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we're going, listen, I am not a fan of the government intervening on every aspect of our lives, but at some point there are certain things where you start creating these epidemics and you start creating these situations where children start getting a hold of this stuff, and children who have been bullied or they don't feel good about themselves. You know, we already have an identity crisis in this country with children. Mm-hmm. You know, they start now getting mom and dad's Ozempic, or they start getting this other compounded drug and they stick the needle in them without telling anybody. And now they're in a diabetic coma, or they're in, you know, they're in some other type of kidney failure or liver failure or heart failure. I mean, these are the serious conversations that people have to have. But from an audit and risk standpoint, I agree with you. I think a lot of patients are saying, can't you just do something to get it approved? Because this is some expensive crap, man. Mm-hmm. And docs are going to get
that's what scares me, is that the docs want to be helpful.
Yep.
And they sign off on this when, in fact, it doesn't meet the coverage requirements of the payer. And they do something that will make it meet those coverage requirements. So, you know, I think this is across the board. It's not just a Medicare issue. I think this is probably more private payer than anything else.
I don't disagree with you. Mm-hmm. I actually agree with you 100%. I think the age bracket that this fits into is teens to 65. And I think the commercial payers are going to crack down on this in a big way. And I agree with you. I think this becomes the biggest audit target by Q3, Q4, 2024 and drives into 2025.
Very possible.
I bet we see hearings on the Hill about the damages that these medications have caused, unfortunately. I hope that's not the case, but my guess is probably what's going to happen.
And I can tell you, it's going to be an SIU target because the cost is just, you know, it's significant. It really is. And it's, you know, these folks are having to take these shots once a week, and essentially they're having to take them for quite a while to really get the results that they need. And then there's some question of, if you stop, you know, there's some evidence that people gain the weight right back if they're not careful.
Mm-hmm. Listen, as somebody who has had moments during my career where I've looked back and I've thought to myself, how did I go from an extreme athlete in college to being Jabba the Hutt to being back in some shape to now being Jabba the Hutt Jr. back to, listen, I've struggled with it myself. Before we went live, I was like, wow, I should really try to zoom my camera out. I look like I'm like much bigger than what I actually am. So that didn't work. So I think it's the beard that's just making me look puffy today. No comments from the peanut gallery.
You always look great, Sean.
not a fraction compared to how good you always look, my friend. And Robert, you do. You look.
Yeah, good. You know, for my age, I'm all right.
You're all right for an old man.
You know, 85 years old.
Yeah. All right. So listen, I am so grateful that we were able to get our first episode of 2024 Legal with Lyles Parker back onto the Compliance Guy podcast. This is a once a month program with Ashley and Robert because they are so very busy and we are all so grateful and appreciative of their time. So that's going to wrap up this episode of the Compliance Guy for today. As always, I want to thank Robert and Ashley for doing such an incredible job, being so well prepared and being good sports as we move through the lightning round today. And to each and every single one of you, as always, thank you so much for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with us just for a little while. I'll be back next week with a brand new Monday auditing, coding, and compliance roundtable. And we have some great episodes lined up for y'all next week. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.